The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm Denver Frederick, and tonight we're going to talk about worms and parasites. More specifically, neglected tropical diseases that affect one out of every seven people on the planet. But some remarkable progress has been made in recent years, in large part because of the End Fund. And you will hear from their CEO, Ellen Agler, who has also just come out with a brand new book titled Under the Tree, Extraordinary Stories from the Movement to End Neglected Tropical Diseases. And some of these diseases have been with us for a very long time.
Well, it's interesting because I think a lot of these diseases are ancient diseases.
Yeah,
I mean,
they've
been around for thousands of years.
And the tombs.
Yeah, right. Egyptian tombs. You see trachoma. And with river blindness, it is a parasite that lives in a small black fly that only is around fast-flowing rivers. And so you would used to find places in West Africa decades ago where they would call it the Valley of the Blind or the River of the Blind because half of the population would become blinded by these diseases.
And then I'll speak with Mike Brady, the CEO of Grayston Bakery. They have a radical hiring model, probably unlike anything you've ever heard, called open hiring.
If you want a job at Grayston, all you need to do is come to the front door of the bakery, put your name on a list, and when we have a job available, we take the next person off the list and give them a chance. No questions asked, no background checks, no interviews, you know, no references. We are just trusting in the power of people to be successful. So we give everyone an equal chance at that.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, January 20th. CVS Health has announced a five-year, $100 million commitment to building community health and wellness nationwide. The United Nations said the ozone hole would be fully healed over the Arctic and Northern Hemisphere by the 2030s and the rest of the world by 2060. A combat-disabled U.S. Air Force veteran who started the GoFundMe page to help fund building the border wall wants to shift that cash to a nonprofit with the same purpose. The new nonprofit is called We Build the Wall, Inc. About 46% of American museums have all-white boards of directors, but the American Alliance of Museums hopes that figure will change for the better soon. Over the next 3 years, the Alliance will receive $4 million to bolster board diversity in a push to make museums more accessible and inclusive. The Ford, Andrew Mellon, and Alice Walton Foundations joined forces to award the grant. Luxembourg is set to become the first country in the world to make all of its public transport free. Plans call for all fares on trains, trams, and buses to be lifted by next summer. And finally, the population of wild tigers in Nepal was found to have nearly doubled in the last 9 years, thanks to efforts by conservationists and increased funding for protected areas. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back to speak with Ellen Agler of the End Fund right after this.
You probably know Sesame Street as the TV show that taught you letters and numbers, but Sesame is so much more. Sesame Workshop is a nonprofit with a mission to help all children grow smarter, stronger, and kinder. Big Bird wants to help, so he started the Yellow Feather Fund to bring education to children in need. You can help too. Visit yellowfeatherfund.org to learn more or make a donation. That's yellowfeatherfund.org. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
Neglected tropical diseases, NTDs, affect over 1 billion of the world's poorest people. More than 170,000 people die from them each year. And many more suffer from blindness, disability, disfigurement, cognitive impairment, and stunted growth. Yet, NTDs are treatable and preventable, and the annual cost of treatment is incredibly low. An organization that is leading the effort to combat NTDs is the End Fund, And it is a pleasure to have with us tonight their CEO, Ellen Agler, who has just come out with a new book titled Under the Big Tree, Extraordinary Stories from the Movement to End Neglected Tropical Diseases. Good evening, Ellen, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you for having me.
Give us a snapshot of the END Fund and what you were created to do.
The END Fund, well, what END stands for is Ending Neglected Diseases. So we were created to focus exclusively on that. We work on controlling and eliminating the five most prevalent neglected tropical diseases that, as you said, affect over a billion people.
You know, the phrase neglected tropical diseases can stop you in your tracks. As you just said, it's a billion people. They're experiencing long-term suffering and disability. Why have they been neglected for so long?
Well, it's interesting because the history of these diseases being called neglected tropical diseases is only about a decade old. Mm. And before, you had people advocating for, let's do more to support schistosomiasis or lymphatic filariasis or onchocerciasis. And as you can tell, by the time I get to the third disease, no one can remember what the titles are or barely pronounce them. So a lot of folks working on these parasitic diseases realize they have in common similar drug delivery. They are affecting the same population in terms of the poorest, most vulnerable people in developing countries. And oftentimes their root cause is water and sanitation related. So maybe we should call them neglected tropical diseases and we'll get further in our advocacy. So, you know, for parasitologists, this was a good marketing play. But the thing is that the diseases aren't neglected because you think, okay, 1.5 billion people have them. Obviously, that's not neglected. It's not like they're rare diseases.
Yeah.
But they are neglected in terms of not as high on the global health agenda and oftentimes just not getting very much funding. They traditionally have had, under the Millennium Development Goals, they were called other diseases. You know, they weren't just getting the visibility. And I think since we started calling them neglected tropical diseases, they're a little less neglected. There's a little more funding to them. But still, I always think it's not the diseases that are neglected, it's the people that are neglected.
Yeah, yeah. And also, so much of the money goes to diseases which have a higher mortality rate. Isn't that correct?
Yes, it is true. It's interesting, though, because you mentioned the 170,000 people die per year. Compared to 1 billion, that's small. But actually, those numbers are mostly from the disease schistosomiasis.
Yeah.
And that is, this makes it the second biggest killer in terms of parasitic disease after malaria.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not small,
no.
But it's mostly linked to disability and illness and anemia and just not thriving.
And being ostracized.
Yeah. So I think it's true that a lot of times we've been focusing on what helps people survive, but not necessarily also thrive. And these are diseases about reducing disability.
Absolutely right. Well, what was the end objective, Ellen, you had in mind when you set out to write Under the Tree?
Well, one of the things when I became CEO of the END Fund in 2012, and I was in this process of reading everything about neglected tropical diseases. I mean, I've been in public health for a long time, but not I'm not an expert in these diseases. And I found that everything written was in an academic, peer-reviewed journal. There was very little out there that just told the stories of people's lives who were suffering from the diseases. And the more that I met people in the field, I just got so inspired by the scientists who are inventing medicines who years later won a Nobel Prize, or the woman who's in her 90s now who came up with the word river blindness, and she's still out there as a public health advocate, or people who'd overcome the diseases that had been ostracized that are now in their community helping others get treatment. And I just thought if I could help bring some of these stories forward, maybe it would help reduce the neglect a bit of the attention and awareness about these diseases. And hopefully, I think what I was inspired by when I started this work was, how do you solve a problem that affects a billion people?
Yeah.
How do you even get your head around that?
Mm-hmm.
And it really takes a lot of different actors. And so I wanted to show, what is that from the government perspective, the philanthropy perspective, the, you know, local community health worker perspective, and just take that snapshot of what the system is to tackle a really big problem and what kind of collaboration it takes.
As you say, with these diseases, it's just another way to lower the barrier by telling stories as opposed to this academia. Between the names and the academic journals, it's hard to get access to. Well, speaking of 2012, the collective movement, if you will, really crystallized then with the London Declaration on Neglected Diseases. Who were the key players behind that declaration, and what was declared?
Well, that was a really great moment, I think, for neglected tropical diseases, where a lot of these key players came together, donors, governments, implementing partners that were doing work on the ground, and said, we want to put a stake in the ground. And pharma companies increased their donations.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, the five diseases that the END Fund works on, all of the medicines are donated for as long as it takes to control or eliminate those diseases. So that was a huge declaration.
Sure,
a lot
is.
Of drug donation programs have been taking place for a while, but this has really stepped that up.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it was a commitment of new funding. So USAID and DFID, the UK and US bilateral funding agencies, increased their funding, which really helped bring in philanthropists. And also at that time, there was very few countries that had a national plan to tackle neglected tropical diseases. And that just kicked off a movement where country after country, you see now having a national plan that they've designed to tackle these diseases. So it really was it wasn't that was the beginning, because there's been work taking place for many decades before that on neglected diseases, but it just really took it, I think, to the next level in terms of this.
A lot of people. Well, let's discuss a few of these diseases. You mentioned a moment ago river blindness. How did that treatment come about, and what was the role that Merck played in it?
Well, it's interesting because I think a lot of these diseases are ancient diseases.
Yeah,
I mean, they've been around for thousands of years.
And the tombs.
Yeah, right, Egyptian tombs. You see trachoma. And with river blindness, it is a parasite that lives in a small black fly that only is around fast-flowing rivers. And so you would used to find places in West Africa decades ago where they would call it the Valley of the Blind or the River of the Blind, because half of the population would become blinded by these diseases. And you could just get so much of this parasite in your system, it would cause blindness and also this really painful, scratchy all the time. And the people just would suffer so much from that. And actually, river blindness was the first health program that the World Bank ever took on.
Yeah.
After Robert McNamara, that was under his leadership. And Merck, at that early days, it was actually treated by helicopter spraying insecticide. It was like a $1 billion program.
Yeah. Right.
And then finally, when they Merck developed ivermectin, that was William Campbell was the scientist leading their work at the time, who won a Nobel Prize back in 2015 for his work. That revolutionized things. Then you didn't have to just treat killing the flies. You could treat people consecutively over a number of years. So what you see with river blindness now is that there's very little blindness left. There's still some of the itching disease, but you need to treat sometimes for up to 17 years. Mm-hmm. But there are pockets, especially in South Sudan, where it is still causing blindness. But the goal now has gone from not just controlling the disease, but to eliminating transmission. And that now has taken place in most of Latin America. The disease has been eliminated, and we're launching
working on
Africa, which is a tougher spot, but certainly caused a lot of suffering for many, many years. And that's really turning the tide. I'd say of all the NTDs, river blindness was the pioneer.
Yep. You know, for those who advocate for effective altruism, and that's the movement of getting the most bang for your charitable buck, deworming, and especially in the schools, is right at the top of the list every single year. Tell us about this and the impact that it's had.
Well, it's interesting because I'm so glad that the effective altruism community has looked at this, and they are so stringent at the data that they look at. And it really, they want to see what has been from randomized control trials compared to other interventions. And I think what a lot of the studies have shown is that deworming not is only a great bang for your buck with health, but also that it reduces school absenteeism significantly by up to 30%.
Wow.
And on these longitudinal studies, it's been shown that people earn more money as adults if they've been dewormed as a child. So it's got these knock-on effects from economic, health, education, that really is a lever for development. And you see that kids that are dewormed and communities that are dewormed are just thriving compared to ones that aren't. And in the last 10 years, when you think about the progress of the NTD movement, 10 years ago, it was only about 1 in 5 kids were getting access to deworming treatment. And now it's 1-7 out of every 10 school-aged children. So, yeah, it's really, it can be anywhere from 25 to 50 cents per child to get them dewormed. It's just remarkably, you know, you think about the cost of your latte, you can deworm 5 or 6 kids.
Yeah, that's effective altruism. Yeah. I didn't want to ask you about this one because I didn't want to have to say it, but I will. And that's schistosomiasis. And that's the second biggest killer among tropical diseases. Mm-hmm. How do you get that? What are the symptoms, and what's the treatment?
You know, you can also just call it schisto if you want to be in the know, or snail fever. Yeah, schistosomiasis is a parasite that lives in a freshwater snail. And so what you find is people who are around water, that are in water. And I always think of it as quite tough because it's a disease that, like, children will get just by being kids, swimming and playing in their local rivers, or people who have livelihoods that they need to be around the water, like fishermen or people who are washing cars at the side of lakes, end up getting exposed to a high burden of this disease. And it can get in your liver and honestly live and breed there for decades before you notice it's such a bad problem. And you know, just causes a massive amount of illness and death
from death in this one. Yeah. So what do you do to treat it?
You treat it with praziquantel, which another company, Merck Serono, donates. Mm-hmm. And also you do a lot of what the focus also with NTDs is prevention education.
Yep.
And so if you are, you know, basic hygiene, using a latrine, washing your hands, you can prevent a lot of these diseases from cycling.
You know, I remember from my days working at the on the restoration of the Statue of Liberty in Ellis Island that the number one reason that was given for immigrants being turned away and sent back across the Atlantic was trachoma. What is trachoma and how do you treat it?
Trachoma is a bacterial disease, actually, and it is so interesting that you remember that from Ellis Island. I think it's true not only for trachoma, but things like hookworm.
Mm-hmm.
We had them in this country. We had them in the United States.
Down south.
And 100 years ago, this was very common. And this is a disease that causes a bacterial infection of the eye, and what happens over time if you have this infection multiple times is your eyelash actually turns inward. So every time you blink, it feels like sand scraping across your eye. It's so painful.
Yeah.
And eventually cause permanent irreversible blindness. And it can be passed from mother to child, from, you know, villager to villager. And very much the strategy for trachoma is an acronym called SAFE. So mm-hmm. if you get that, your eyelash turning in, you can do surgery to correct that. A for antibiotics. Pfizer donates Zithromax so that you can treat entire communities that have a high prevalence of this disease. Facial cleanliness, just keeping your eyes and face clean helps a lot. And environmental improvements, which is around latrines and keeping your environment clean. So it's remarkable because even in the last few years, you've seen many countries come forth and be able to declare the elimination of trachoma.
Yeah.
And that has, with a lot of additional support and people rallying around trachoma, I really believe in the next 10 years, we may have very few spots in the world that have trachoma. So being around for thousands of years, and as we said, that you could find pictures of people with trachoma in the Egyptian tombs, then to Ellis Island being such a thing, it's incredible mm-hmm. to think in our lifetime, in such a short order, we may not have some of these diseases.
Yeah, that's very exciting. With the pharmaceutical companies stepping up the way they have and donating this mm-hmm. medicine, it would seem to me then a real key is the distribution
yes.
of the medicine. How
yes.
is that done? Who does it? And what are some of the bottlenecks you run into?
Yeah. Well, because the way it works with the distribution of medicines for these diseases is you map the prevalence and then you treat everybody at risk mm-hmm. in a certain area. So you're not necessarily testing every single child for worms. You say, okay, we recognize there's 25% or sometimes it's 80% of kids have schistosomiasis or 25%. Just deworming is really, really safe. Let's give it to everybody in this community. And the way that that's done is often through schools.
Mm-hmm.
So for children, bringing everyone together, deworming them through schools or through community health workers that sometimes go door to door or work through clinics. But it's really this amazing army of frontline health workers and teachers. I mean, we've been working with hundreds of thousands of those health workers. And so you need to get drugs into the country, distribute them to the regional and down to the district level. So I always say, like, neglected tropical diseases is as much of a logistical exercise as anything.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the whole community, all of those organizations that signed the London Declaration back in 2012, collectively and all the governments that are committed to distributing medicines, delivered over 1 billion treatments last year. So it really is quite remarkable to see the impact.
Sensational. Well, let's speak about governments a little bit. Give us an example of a nation that has really taken this on in a very conscientious and aggressive fashion, and maybe one which is filled with more challenges.
Sure. Well, one of the predecessor project before the End Fund got started was in Rwanda.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a philanthropist that said, let's do a pilot program. We can do integrated NTD treatment. Rwanda had high burden of intestinal worms and schistosomiasis. And at the time when that got started, it was around 2007, the diseases hadn't even been mapped. There was no government program. Some of the places they found schools where 80% of the kids had high burden of
mm-hmm.
these diseases. And if you think about roundworms, each worm is 8 to 12 inches long. A child with a moderate infection could have 200 worms. So it's a serious problem. And if you get dewormed once or twice a year, you just never get that bad of an infection, even if a few worms resurge. So,
worms.
Yeah.
I think
a lot
you
of
said
worms.
You put them end to end, there's 16 stories or something.
Something like that, yes. That's true. Crazy to think about here in New York.
Yeah.
There was an NGO that went in and supported the government. So
mm-hmm.
they had a bigger group of expats and folks from the region and technical experts that supported the government at the beginning. And over time, that decreased. Till the government was running the whole program all on their own. They still needed some external financing.
Mm-hmm.
And just this year, Rwanda announced that they're fully taking on board financing and managing the entire project on their own. And that was a process over a number of years. But they embedded it within the health system. They trained the 40,000 community health workers. They've now got, you can go to labs and the technicians know how to test and treat for worms. There's got just a regular part of school health days once or twice a year. And so that's exciting because, you know, I think that's the holy grail of a lot of development programs is how do you really get to sustainability, especially when the diseases aren't eradicated, like we hope polio or guinea worm will be. They need to have some maintenance of these programs. Kids might not be sick, but you still have an infection or resurge once in a while. So that is great. I think the challenging places are, I mean, Rwanda is a small country.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you look at Nigeria or Ethiopia, I mean, Ethiopia has a population of 90 million people. 70 million have one or more of these neglected tropical diseases. So, you know, Nigeria, two out of every three Nigerians have one or more of these diseases. And, you know, it's a federal country. So it's almost like every different state is sort of managed differently. So there's, you know, I think, and then there's also places where conflict, you know, we have work in South Sudan, we work in the Central African Republic, Somalia. Mm-hmm. We do actually get work done. Matter of fact, one of the places that inspires me the most right now is Yemen. We've been treating river blindness and schistosomiasis in Yemen even with the conflict going on. And the local team is so committed and so focused on getting, you know, this right and getting this done that even in places I think people think, oh, you can't get anything done. Actually, you can get stuff done. But it's more of a challenge, for sure.
Does climate change have any impact on tropical diseases?
Absolutely. The mosquitoes are moving north. I saw Al Gore give his talk, and he always puts up a slide about neglected tropical diseases because it's not just the ones we're talking about, but also dengue and chikungunya. And I think it's a concern because it changes the map of where these diseases are. And we've seen them now coming across the border into Texas. There was some south of France had some cases of schistosomiasis. So, you know, we think, well, you know, these are things only in Africa, but really they are also diseases that we have to be careful don't resurge. Yeah. And also it's not just climate change, but things like the underlying economic and social infrastructure. So we've seen in the American South actually hookworms starting to resurge in places that don't have good sewage and water and sanitation systems. So we have to, I think, be vigilant everywhere when it comes to these diseases.
Ellen, is there economic data on these diseases on how much could be saved or what the increased productivity could be if they were eliminated?
Well, there was a great study that Erasmus University did looking at the London Declaration goals, saying what could be saved. And just for Africa, they estimated $52 billion in additional economic gains could be earned if we controlled and eliminated these diseases by 2020. So I think it was the number was $600 billion globally. I mean, it is significant.
Yeah, significant.
And I think that's what is important to think about. It's not just from a health perspective, but what could you unleash in terms of human potential just by people not being so anemic and not able to go to work or not able to go to school, which is actually when you look at the Rockefeller Foundation starting in the American South, it was all around eradicating hookworm.
Right.
It was the Rockefeller Commission to eradicate hookworm. And apparently John D. Rockefeller sent an economic commission down to the South first before starting the hookworm project. And they wanted to do more in agriculture and said, well, everybody looks sick there. most of the places where they were unfortunately calling it like laziness disease, but it turned out it was not laziness, it was anemia.
Yeah,
and there was widespread anemia from hookworm. And until they were able to address anemia, they weren't going to be able to have that kind of economic productivity. So I think there's a real link between health and how we do more broadly in society.
For sure. What role does technology, smartphones and things like that, play in this effort?
Oh, it's amazing now. I mean, there's such great smartphones and apps and digital platforms used to collect data, to do mapping, and also a lot of just trying to have an open source platform for who's doing what where. So there's these great websites called like This Wormy World, the Trachoma Atlas, if you want to get on and like get really granular about what are the diseases and who's being treated and what are the gaps. And I think that's great because I think in terms of a community
for
this large,
like you it is.
I know. You know, I got that nickname Worm Lady.
You did.
And I'm embracing it. It's a badge of honor now. A friend's son gave me that nickname and it seems to have stuck and
it fits.
You know, you're lucky I didn't bring today my big jar of worms that I sometimes bring to talks.
I consider it a blessing that I didn't get to see it. The N Fund was created with a systems view, and you could accurately be described as a systems entrepreneur. How does that differ from a social entrepreneur, and what different skill sets are needed?
Well, I think about looking at something from a systems view as the founders of the N Fund thought, you know, there are many great organizations, whether it's the Carter Center or Sight Savers or Helen Keller or small local nonprofits that might just work in one country that are doing good work, governments that are doing different work. So how do we make sure we're not duplicating efforts? And the idea of spending time mapping the whole ecosystem, who's doing what where, how can you help make some organizations more efficient or just support them with additional funding? Or how do you see, okay, there's a big gap here, nothing's happening, how do we intervene there? How do we support local partners? So that was a lot of the folks who founded the N Fund came from the financial world. So when they thought fund, they're like, that means we're going to support a portfolio of programs, lots of different organizations to help all sort of boats rise and really keep our eye at that system level. And I think for that, system entrepreneur is certainly common to trend as a phrase that I like. I think it's like, you know, and I'm not sure it's like has to be system versus social entrepreneur, but I do think that system level view is something that we need now. Like, how do organizations work together? What are those intersection points? How do you foster collaboration? How do you decide what not to do as an organization because you know someone else is better at it? Mm-hmm. And I think having that walls down sort of, you know, managed ego, put your logos aside, how do we get together around a common cause for a common goal? I see that happening really, really well in the neglected tropical disease community. And I think that there are lessons to learn about just having common goals and many organizations.
What are some of those lessons? Because you're absolutely right. You have power dynamics. You have different worldviews. You have all these things going. And you mentioned there with the egos and the logos, everybody looking to promote their own organization, if not themselves.
Yeah.
How do you somehow, you know, suppress that? And sit at the table with everybody else and have that trust and begin to move ahead.
Well, sometimes I think there's a view that you need, you know, you sit in your specific organization and so you see things through your organization lens. But actually, the government doesn't want to see it that way. So for us with the N Fund, we thought, okay, we could engage a lot of new private philanthropists to join the neglected tropical disease cause. But what if we had 30 new private philanthropy foundations going to meet with the Minister of Health in Rwanda? That's just going to be an extra burden for them. So why don't we get ourselves together, co-fund, and then go as one collective voice to negotiate?
Sort of like a United Way.
Or we go with U.S. SNFIT and you know, we'll all go together. So I think part of it is, who is your audience? Like, the audience is the beneficiaries. Mm-hmm. Your audience might be a government that you're working with, or your audience is the World Health Organization. And there was a great example. And then those people want to hear, like, what does the whole disease community want?
Sure.
They don't want to hear from 100 different organizations. So the more, I think,
value their time.
Yeah. It really is. Like, how do we make sure in these places with limited resources that you're really maximizing time and voice? And I saw this happen with trachoma, where all the trachoma organizations got together and created this assessment of what is the global trachoma burden, where are the gaps, and what is the cost going to be?
Mm-hmm.
And that, and they didn't even, they started something called the International Coalition for Trachoma Control. That wasn't even an organization. They just put a logo on the front, all their individual logos on the back. And that is what sold, like, Queen Elizabeth Diamond Jubilee Trust and the UK government to put a bunch more money into trachoma. Because they thought, okay, these partners know how to play well together in their sandbox. And I think
that resonates.
Yeah, it resonates.
Really, really, really does. Yeah. It resonates so much that you've been able to get a pretty good deal of unrestricted funding, correct?
We have. It's a mix. I mean, I think we have some unrestricted, some restricted. We've had... What's interesting, even about the restricted funds that we get, though, is that some of it is to cover our overhead because people see they love this fund model and they want to see how can we onboard new people into in a way that really promotes collaboration and coordination. So there are investors in the N Fund that just say, I want to be an unrestricted investor. I can be a part of everything in the portfolio. You're supporting dozens of organizations in dozens of countries doing really innovative work. But sometimes we also get people who say, I really love Zimbabwe. I just want to do something in Zimbabwe. And I think what we've said is we want to be able to easily engage people in the sector and do so in a way that every dollar goes the furthest.
Yeah.
And if we have ways to onboard, ideally is unrestricted, of course. But then, you know, I think we also don't want to turn people away if they have specific passions. And there's a need. I mean, we have turned some funding away where we're like, that's not really a need or that's not a match with what the countries need.
You know, when you talked about how the N Fund got started with a lot of people from the financial industry and Western philanthropists, as you have evolved, have you been able to get others involved at a very high level from the places where this work is being done.
Yes, actually. What I love about the NFUNS board is we do have a very international board. And even from the beginning, we had, you know, some of our founders are based in Dubai. Mm-hmm. We had the UK, US. But I knew from day one of starting with the NFUNS that I really was hoping to get, you know, if we're working in Africa, can we get African investors to support this work and be a voice? So now we have a Nigerian board member who runs one of the largest private equity funds focused on Africa, and a Zimbabwean philanthropist who is a great activist and advocate, and she does a lot of work. So it's not only putting dollars, it's really about using voice, making introductions. And I think that that's helped a lot because it has been just corporate leaders and civil society locally that have really stepped up. So we do a lot more sometimes funding governments directly, funding like a Nigerian NGO or mm-hmm. a Congolese NGO. And by having more people from the countries that are represented on, even on our board and our technical advisory group, yeah. it's helped a lot.
You began your career as a journalist, Ellen. Where did the turn occur that got you into the field of international development and humanitarian causes?
Well, I had an editor who would send me out. I loved my career in journalism. That's probably why I came back to write this book, too, because I just loved interviewing and going deep in stories. And But at some point...
That was your itch.
That was my itch. But I also, I think I've always been attracted to having an impact, and it must have been something when I was in journalism that I got attached to things, because I would end up doing a story about the Commission for the Blind is going bankrupt, and then I would volunteer to read books for the blind, or refugee resettlement, and then I would volunteer for it. I had an editor who's like, I think you're in the wrong field. Maybe you need to look. You're getting way too attached to the stories that I send you on. And I thought at the time, oh, maybe I'll go into the Peace Corps for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll do something. And actually, I got introduced to the organization Operation Smile then, and ended up spending 2 years with them, thinking I would come back to journalism.
Yeah.
And it just transformed my worldview and sense of what I wanted to do. And
this
so here I am 25 almost years later working in global health. And I love it.
Describe the corporate culture at the NFUNS and how what you do, and you're a bit of a broker between philanthropists mm-hmm. and the actual work being done on the ground. How is that reflected in the workplace culture of the NFUNS?
Yeah, the NFUNS is a small team. We're about 35 people now, and with a big impact because we do support so many partners. So last year, our work was able to translate into, you know, 100 million people getting treatment in more than 25 countries. So I think that that sense of, and it was started, the DNA is very much from the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just started with that real, like, scrappy, impact focused, how do you go get the most out of your dollar? And also, we did this great sort of survey amongst our staff recently, and, you know, there was sort of 100% of people feeling like they were just really mission aligned with what they were doing. And that also they really appreciate the flexibility of the work culture. I think we have people traveling around the world and partners everywhere. And I think that there's still that sense of we're only 6 years old. So it's still a young enough organization that it's been a fast growth every year.
Yeah, sure has.
So we've still really got a lot of energy and innovation. So I feel like we're doing more on just having, you know, team retreats, figuring out ways to have balance. I think we're all trying to figure that out. But I think we have had very little turnover.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people, I think, get in this work and they just love it. And it's a real mix of, you know, people from the fundraising and marketing to disease experts, quite a global community, people that have lived all around the world. We are headquartered here in New York, but mm-hmm. Since we have projects everywhere, a lot of us are on the road a lot.
Yeah.
So,
and it's funny with those fast-growing organizations, too, is that people never get stuck in a job because new jobs are almost being created all the time because new opportunities have come up.
I know. I started as the CEO. I was the first full-time hire of the NFUNS.
Mm-hmm.
So I was employee number one. And I think, okay, I've had the same title these last 6 years, but it has been a completely different job every year because of the different partners that we're bringing on board, the new places that we're working. It's been great. But I think you have to like for the fast-paced, constantly evolving startup sort of culture to do well.
Sure. Let me close with this, Ellen. You map all this work.
Mm-hmm.
You know where we stand now, and you have a pretty good idea where this movement is headed into the future. So how close or how far do you believe we are from the end of neglected tropical diseases?
Well, I could give you a very technical answer because end is always the difference between control versus eliminate versus eradicate.
Right.
Go down a rabbit hole of definitions.
Mm-hmm.
So I think end, to me, you have to define end broadly as these diseases are no longer a public health problem. People are no longer vastly ill, and even if they do need treatment, they have access to treatment because some of these aren't going to be completely eradicated.
Yep.
But what we're seeing now is when I started at the End Fund 6 years ago, the number was closer to like 1.8 billion people that were at risk. Now that number is below 1.5. So even in that time, 300 million people no longer need treatment for some of these diseases.
Pretty fast.
And when we've modeled out what will this look like if we stay on track between now and 2030, we think by 2030, that number could be closer to 200 million people globally. So that's over a billion people.
Yeah.
That could be really over
billion
the next
and a half, yeah.
Decade. It's remarkable. And I think that is unprecedented sort of in human history that this could happen now. We work a lot with the Gates Foundation, who feels like these diseases are the ones that are going to be able to be ended sort of before malaria.
Mm-hmm.
That one's going to a little bit further out. So, yeah, I have a massive amount of optimism just because I've seen it in country after country. These diseases come under control and people aren't really going blind as much from river blindness. And this should be the last generation where you see people with elephantiasis have access to that kind of treatment. And that's just diseases no one should have to live with.
Well, there's not a lot of good news out there, and this has to be one of the big-time good news stories. Well, Ellen Agler, the CEO of the End Fund, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. The book, again, is Under the Tree, Extraordinary Stories from the Movement to End Tropical Diseases. Now, where can people go to find out more about the End Fund and more about this book?
I would suggest going to our website at end.org. It has all the information you would need on the End Fund and also the book.
Fantastic. Thanks, Ellen. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you. This was wonderful.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Most teachers spend more than $500 of their own money on school supplies each year. That's because too many classrooms lack books, microscopes, art supplies, and even pencils. At DonorsChoose.org, you can help students and teachers get the resources they need for a successful education. Whether you support a field trip to a local museum, yoga mats for a health class, or technology to teach kids to code, you can join the 2 million individuals who've already made a difference in the classroom. Visit DonorsChoose.org to bring a classroom dream to life. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
I caught up with Carl Zinnmeister, the author of The Almanac of American Philanthropy, and asked that he share with us several stories of great American philanthropists. And here are two. The first is Alfred Loomis, who, by the way, is a great-grandfather of Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix. This is what Carl had to say about him.
Boy, it's just criminal, Denver, that we don't learn some of this stuff in school. I was just embarrassed when I figured out how important Alfred Loomis was in the course of World War II to realize that I was, you know, in my 50s before I'd ever heard a word about the guy. So Alfred Loomis was he's one of those guys, you probably know him, that just loved science ever since they were knee-high to a grasshopper. Just, you know, couldn't get enough of experimentation. He always knew that's what he loved. But his father died when he was in college, and he realized he was possibly going to have to support the whole family, and saw he better get serious about making money. So he went to law school, hated that, and wanted to get back to science, but realized that if he wanted to do science on a really big level, on a great level, he's going to need a pile of money to do it. So he got together with his brother-in-law, and he said, let's go to Wall Street and make some serious money. And this was a highly talented man, obviously. And the two guys, the two brothers and brothers-in-law, formed a firm that basically financed most of the rural electrification of America. They wrote about 40% of the bonds that electrified America. That was kind of the internet craze of its day.
Yeah,
big
sure.
deal.
Big stuff.
And they made a pile of money. And then he just brilliantly anticipated the stock market meltdown, and he went to all cash as of the summer of 1929. And of course, the market collapsed in October. Why don't you and I think of these things, Denver? Anyway, so when the market crashed, he bought, and long story short, he became one of the richest men in America by the early 30s. And as he had kind of suggested to everyone he was going to, he completely retired from finance at that point. Finance was just a utilitarian thing for him. He had the money he needed, and he went back to science. And Alfred Loomis was not just a dabbler. He was a serious scientist. For instance, he was one of the early guys that discovered brain waves, and wave theory in general was something he was very good at. He was an expert in the precise measurement of time. Kind of wonky stuff, but here's what happened where it came in handy. So in 1938, I believe it was, Alfred Loomis takes a trip to Berlin, and he's stunned by two things. One is how popular Hitler is, just really surprised him. And second, how great the German scientists were and how far advanced they were in many
areas. That worried him.
And boy, he came home just terrified and started just ringing the alarm bells to everybody he knew in government. He was very well connected, and he started telling everybody, you have to get on nuclear weapons. You have to get on all these different things. And they said, oh, that's for tomorrow's war. And he said, no, it's not. He said, the Germans are making incredible progress. The Japanese presumably are doing the same thing. We have to be first. And was enormously frustrated at how sluggish and bureaucratic the official government, you know, weapons research labs were. He actually had some firsthand experience. During World War One, he'd worked in, which one was it? It's the one in New Jersey. I think it's, I'm sorry, I don't remember. One of the weapons labs. And he was just couldn't believe how slow-moving they were and bureaucratic. So he said, I'm going to short-circuit this whole process. So he hired a bunch of folks, and he went to work on what he thought might be, you know, kind of a promising technology that would could help in the war effort, which was to use radio waves to measure the direction and speed of moving objects, which is, of course, what we now call radar.
Radar, right.
Didn't exist at that point. And in very short order, in this private lab, with his own money, Alfred Loomis became not only the theoretical leader in the country on how radar works, but he actually started leading production of working radar sets that went into ships and planes and shore installations. And FDR said that nobody other than Winston Churchill had more to do with winning World War II than Alfred Loomis.
The other story is about Michael Brown, certainly not a famous name in philanthropy, but whose generosity left an indelible mark on American literature.
He was a Broadway lyricist, okay? And all of your New York listeners know that's your classic boom and bust profession. You can go a lot of years
sure.
without a paycheck, you know, and then suddenly get lucky and you get a big paycheck. And that's what happened. He had a hit musical. I'm trying to remember. This is roughly the mid-50s.
Yeah, 56,
he had a hit
I think
musical.
It was.
Yep, yep. And so he had this income, and he felt blessed and lucky, and he wanted to help somebody. So he looked around. They had a family friend who was your classic starving artist in New York City. She had grown up in Alabama and decided she wanted to become a novelist. And what do people from Alabama who want to become novelists do? They move to Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
And what do they do when they get there? They end up working in bookstores and restaurants, right, in most cases. And that's exactly what happened to this family friend. And she was just languishing and not making any progress on her novel. And, you know, the Browns, Mr. and Mrs. Brown, were good friends. They noticed this. They saw the pain. They saw that she was not meeting her full human potential. And that's kind of, for me, Denver, that's the definition of philanthropy, is you look at a fellow human being who's not meeting their potential, and you say, I can help.
Yeah.
You know, with a little boost from me, they can meet their potential. And the Browns made a very bold and brave decision. They invited her over for Christmas, this friend, and they said, at the end of their gift exchange with their two boys and their family, they said, there's a little thing on the tree for you. And so this novel writer went over and picked up an envelope off the tree and opened it. And inside it was a simple note that just said, you have 1 year off from your work, which was this bookstore job and an airline job that she had to just make ends meet. You have 1 year off to do nothing but write. Merry Christmas. The name of this artist was Harper Lee.
Oh, wow.
And it was during that gift year, she agonized, first of all. She wasn't sure if it was right for her to take her friend's money in this way. She really agonized. But she decided in the end she would do her best, and she was going to take him up on the offer. So she did. She quit her job, and she went to work. And it was during that year that Harper Lee produced To Kill a Mockingbird, which, of course, won the Pulitzer and became one of the most really influential pieces of American literature ever.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Tiana was homeless and looking for a change. At Year Up, she gained valuable skills and a path to success. 85% of Year Up alumni are employed or in school within 4 months of graduation. Support transformative opportunities for young adults like Tiana. Visit yearup.org. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
There are certain business practices that almost everyone adheres to and, through hard work, look to improve and make even better and more effective. Hiring would be one such example. But what if a company came along and turned those practices on their head? In fact, did just about the exact opposite of what is universally prescribed. What kind of outcomes would they achieve with their hiring? Well, to find that out, we're going to speak to someone who has done precisely that. He is Mike Brady, the CEO of Grayston Bakeries. Good evening, Mike, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here.
First, Mike, give us some of the history of Grayston Bakery and where you're based and what you bake.
I'd be happy to. Yeah, you know, it's better to think of the bakery as a food manufacturing facility. We are a 36-year-old food manufacturing facility based in Yonkers, New York, which is, you know, directly north of Manhattan. And we make brownies primarily, but it's not as if we're doing tray by tray. We make about a tractor trailer of brownies a day, about 8 million pounds a year. And we do it for some well-known brands like Ben & Jerry's, Whole Foods, Delta Airlines. So if you've ever enjoyed a nice pint of chocolate fudge brownie ice cream, those are our brownies.
All righty. You know, it's been said that the founder of Grayston Bakery, Bernie Glassman, had infused the company with a Buddhist perspective. How would that be the case?
Yes. Well, we owe a lot to our visionary founder, Zen master, Bernie Glassman, and that when he started Grayston years ago, he had a vision for creating a business that not only made money and was able to sustain itself, but also gave back to the community. Mm-hmm. So we have a model of open hiring, which is based very much on his Buddhist principles of non-judgment and embracing uncertainty.
Tell us a little bit about that open hiring model. How does it work?
Yeah, well, you gave a nice kind of quick overview in the lead-in, in that it's pretty simple to understand, but yet somewhat radical in its practice, in that if you want a job at Grayston, all you need to do is come to the front door of the bakery, put your name on a list, and when we have a job available, we take the next person off the list and give them a chance. No questions asked, no background checks, no interviews, no references. We are just trusting in the power of people to be successful, so we give everyone an equal chance at that.
That is radical for sure. Now, if an individual signs up, how long on average do they generally have to wait before hearing that a job is opened up and they should come by?
Yeah, you know, that's a question I get asked often, and really there's most things at the bakery, although we have this amazing social justice story, are still driven by business needs. So the amount of time you may be on the job list and waiting for the opportunity will be driven by demand for our products. Mm-hmm. And it could be anywhere from 3 months to 6 months, and if we're kind of fully staffed, it may be even up to a year. Mm-hmm. But our goal is clearly to continue to grow our business and continue to hire people, because that's what we're all about.
Well, let's talk a little bit about those people. What is your employee makeup? What are the backgrounds of the people who work at Grayston? Where are they coming from?
Yeah, well, it's a good follow-up question, in that in many ways, the wait period on the list ensures we're kind of reaching those that are most in need of a job.
That's a great point.
And that can be any numbers of people, but unfortunately there's, you know, typical or standard types of backgrounds and people that have a really difficult time getting access in the workforce, and those can be people that have had experience with the social justice system. Mm-hmm. We have a number of single mothers who've been out of the workforce for a period of time and have a hard time getting access to jobs. We have refugees that have come, they're legally able to work in the United States, but have no work history, so they have a hard time gaining access to employment. And then people that have faced any number of hardships, which could be dealing with addiction or homelessness. And when typical employers see a gap in the resume, they are very hesitant about giving someone a chance, whereas at Grayston, we don't care, as long as you can deliver what we need from you on the job.
What are the biggest misconceptions you think that employers have about that group of people?
That's another easy one, in that there's some kind of inherent risk in giving people a chance. And the reality is Grayston hasn't experienced, and nor do we have insurance rates or worker comp rates or any business costs that demonstrate there's any greater risk in giving someone a chance to be successful than having a really costly and traditional HR practice.
Yeah. How much does that save you, by the way, by not having to do all those background checks and things of that sort? I don't even know what that runs.
Yeah, yeah. We talk about a couple statistics. The SHRM, the Society of Human Resource Management, estimates it's about $4,200 on average to bring someone on board at a traditional business. At Grayston, it's $1,900.
Yeah.
And that's for, you know, for taking someone off the job list, giving them training, and working with them through our apprenticeship and getting them into our full-time job roles.
Yeah, so that's incredible. You take more of the money in not trying to eliminate people, but actually investing in people.
Well, you know, over $3 billion are spent in our minds filtering people out of the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we take some of that $3 billion and invest it in helping people be successful in the workforce? And that's what our model of open hiring is all about.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talked a little bit about apprenticeship. Tell us a little bit about the receiving, the training that these individuals receive once they come on board.
You know, nothing groundbreaking there. Like any good food manufacturing facility, we focus on three areas. One being kind of food safety and food defense. Second being the hard skills needed to run heavy equipment like we have at our food manufacturing facility. And then the piece that may be a little bit unique, but certainly many places have it, are the soft skills or worker readiness skills that give our team members the greatest chance of being successful on the job.
Mm-hmm.
And the apprenticeship is all about that. And it's two ways, right? It's this accountability, this relationship we develop that says, as long as you come to work and you do these things, we're happy to have you here. And we're going to do everything we can to make you successful. But if you don't deliver on those things, we're going to ask you to leave.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the relationship that's established from day one.
You know, a lot of the issues that many of these workers might have coming from, you know, homelessness or drug addiction or incarceration, they got a lot of things going on in their life. And in order to make them successful, Grayston really has to take a look at how you can support them to be successful in the job. What are some of the things you do around that?
Yeah, that's great. And that gets back a little to our founder, Bernie Glassman, and the work we've been doing over the last 35 years. Now, we've certainly been evolving it more recently as people are paying attention to our model. But it's asking people, like, what is it that's going to prevent you from being successful on the job? And it's a philosophy that we refer to as pathmaking. And it's the principles that Bernie brought to the table that said, hey, we want people to be not only great workers, but thriving in their own lives. And by them becoming thriving individuals, we know that they'll also be great employees. And so it's, you know, the typical things that you might address with anyone coming from Southwest Yonkers and dealing with the challenges in our community. And you alluded to a couple of them: housing, child care, mental health is a big one, conflict resolution, access to healthy food, which you wonder, hey, why is a business concerned about someone's access to healthy food? Well, of course, we want people to have that because that's important to everyone. But we also want people to be healthy, to be able to come to work, to not have sick days, to not have their children experiencing sick days so that they have to stay away from work. So that's the way we frame these path-making services and you know, wanting to deliver them to our team members so that they can not only have better lives, but be more productive at the bakery.
Yeah, and a lot of that's carried out by your nonprofit arm, correct?
Correct. And so thank you for that. All the profits from Grayston Bakery go to support Grayston Foundation and the work we're doing there to help our team members become thriving. But the reality is, and our real mission now is to help other businesses understand that they can embrace these same principles, that they don't need to, you know, have a great level of expertise around affordable housing, let's say, or child care. Because those services more than likely exist in their communities already.
Mm-hmm.
So what businesses need to do is just ensure that they understand what's available in their communities and help their employees gain access to it.
What's your turnover rate? How successful has this been in terms of bringing those employees in and having them stay and retaining them and doing good jobs for you?
Yeah, another good question, and one that is probably a little nuanced because typical businesses will measure their success by retention or turnover. Whereas at Grayston, when people leave the bakery, after they've been here a while, we actually think of that as a success.
Yeah.
You know, people have come here, they've found their path, they've been successful, and then they may find a job that better suits what they want to be in the long term. That's one example of why we think kind of the term retention or churn also needs to change in common employer lexicon, and that Employers should be happy if they get 3-4 years of good work from someone, if they can go on to a job that may build their career outside their businesses. Now, the flip side is, of course, you've invested in those people, and how do you draw those? How do you find and draw those lines? And we do a lot of work around the ROI.
Mm-hmm.
You may also, though, be alluding to kind of the initial churn, and anytime we bring in a cohort, we typically bring in open hires in group of 10, knowing we're going to lose anywhere from, let's say, 30 to 70% of those initial team members because they're not ready to work.
Yeah.
And we welcome people into Greyston with non-judgment, and we also let people leave Greyston with non-judgment. Mm-hmm. So if you're not successful or for whatever reason you're facing obstacles that we can't help you overcome, we don't judge you. We acknowledge that you're not going to be successful at Greyston, and we help you to find your next kind of path in life.
Mm-hmm. You alluded to this a moment ago, Mike, but you've become a bit of a Pied Piper of sorts for this movement and have created a Center for Open Hiring. What specifically does that center do, and are there any signs that this movement is beginning to catch on?
Yeah. Well, I'm delighted to talk about it, and it kind of has stemmed from an interest in Greyston over the last 37 years and other business leaders reaching out to us and saying, hey, you know, Mike or others at Greyston, how do you do what you do? We'd really like to learn. And us not having the capacity at Greyston to act on that. So over the last year and then in June of 2018, we launched what we're calling the Center for Open Hiring to educate, train, and inform other businesses on how they can use our model.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really enthusiastic about it because when we began the project, it was really about, hey, we need to close this gap. We need to give people that are not gaining access to the workforce an opportunity and encourage businesses to be progressive. But what the reality in the economy is now is that there is a talent shortage.
Yeah.
And businesses are looking to gain access to different populations of people. And now we're getting a ton of tailwind from business leaders that say, hey, I need to be more progressive, not necessarily because I care about my community, but hopefully people do,
mm-hmm.
but because they want to grow their businesses.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, aside from building a quality workforce, have there been any other business advantages that have come about as a result of being such a socially conscious organization?
Absolutely. And the kind of learnings that I get every day from this model are tremendous. And it's clear the direct positive impact we have on a person that wouldn't maybe never otherwise get a chance to work are life-changing.
Mm.
But our culture at Greyston and our ability to gain access to talent throughout the organization and tell a story about a social justice organization that's doing something different from everyone else, those are huge competitive advantages for us, both in gaining access to global brands like Delta and Ben & Jerry's, but also gaining access to talent throughout the organization because we're telling a really compelling story.
Yeah. You had touched on the corporate culture at Greyston Bakery. How would you describe it, and what aspect of it do you think is most distinctive and exceptional?
You know, you talk to any business leader, and they're likely going to want to tell you the same story that we have here, which is we've got a team of people that are working for a higher purpose. And we have no shortage of challenges, both at the bakery and the nonprofit.
Mm-hmm.
But every day when we think about, hey, are we able to change people's lives? And are we, you know, are we sitting at the front of a movement to really create an inclusive economy? It creates a culture of change and a culture of people looking to make a difference and really put in that extra effort to solve problems. And I'm really proud of the team we have here and the people that are interested in engaging with us because we're working towards something we really all believe in, and that's creating a better world out there.
Yeah. Let me close with this, Mike. Even if an organization is not going to adopt the open hiring model or even head down that road, are there still lessons from what you have done that could help inform their hiring practices?
Without a doubt. And that's part of the work we'd like to do at the center, which is just to engage people in the conversation. And while at the end of the day, we want people to hire someone that might otherwise not get hired into their organization, just having a sit-down conversation around saying, hey, I want to invite someone in with non-judgment.
Mm.
What would that require us to do? And when you start looking at some of your business practices, you see the bias that's in there because you say, oh, we need these things. But, you know, the simple example is someone doesn't need a high school diploma to stack brownie boxes, brownie crates onto a pallet. Yet so often there'll be these inherent things in job descriptions that prevent people from gaining access to employment.
Yeah, that's a great
point. And as you talk about our model and think about how you can change your own business, you really uncover a lot of good things. So we encourage everyone to think about being much more progressive, because undoubtedly, even if you don't create a model like open hiring, you're going to find better ways to do your human capital practices.
And your motto is?
We don't hire people to bake brownies. We bake brownies to hire people.
I love that. Well, Mike Brady, the CEO of Grayston Bakery, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Where can listeners learn more about this work and the open hiring model?
Yep. I encourage everyone to go on grayston.com. We'll have all our information about the Center for Open Hiring there. We'd love to host you here in Yonkers or come to your site. And then we also have amazing brownies we sell online is another big piece of our business, whether for individual gifts or corporate gifts. Mm-hmm. So let's work together.
An absolutely great story, and I want to thank you so much for being here. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
I very much appreciate the chance to tell the story. So thank you, too.
And that is this week's show. Next week, my guests will be Peggy Delaney, the daughter of David Rockefeller and the founder and chair of a fascinating organization called Synergos. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. And do return next Sunday evening for The Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of The Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.